This is the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast. Stock up with Bud Light for game days and check out Budweiser's limited edition Copper Reserve. Please drink responsibly.
They're going to run and get that boost.
This game's still alive and the Hawks have a first down.
Who wants to talk football?
It's Ronnie Wingo, number 20. Touchdown, Arkansas.
They talk the bar.
This is the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast.
You know, in like the old days and the old medieval times when you had banners, bannermen, you know, holding your banners as you walked down. You think Nick Mason's got a banner that he has like a little flag on the limousine
no,
as he drives in?
I think it's probably more like the movie Coming to America, where the ladies that lay out the rose petals for his every step. It's probably more along those lines.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to clean up some stuff then in the front yard here at the office after the show once he arrives. So we'll have him in studio with us today to talk a lot about the Arkansas Razorback basketball team, which they get back on the winning ways last night. Somehow, some way, that might have been one of the worst starts to a basketball game I've ever seen. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was a full 7 minutes Arkansas went after scoring their first basket. They went without scoring. 7 minutes at home to Missouri. They were down by double digits, and it wasn't like Missouri was setting the world on fire by any stretch. But what an ugly start to a game, but a nice finish for Arkansas. They got back into it. It was a little back-and-forth game there for a while. Arkansas held on to a marginal lead. Seemed like any time that they looked like they were about to pull away, Missouri responded with some three from Mark Smith, because apparently you don't need a guard. And we only went 6 of 11 from three-point land. But anyways, he was the guy that ended up keeping Missouri in the game, but then when it was all said and done, Arkansas went on a nice little streak there. I think it was 11-1 run to close out the game, and they get the victory 72-60 over the Missouri Tigers.
Yeah, it was 12-2 with 14:05 when Missouri scored to make it 12-2 and went up 10, obviously. 14:05 left in the first half. Eventually got to 14-2, and then Arkansas finally got back on the board at the 11:43 mark. With 11:43 to go in the first half, Arkansas had four points and ends up scoring. Think about this. 72 points. They scored 68 points in basically the final 30 minutes of the game.
Yeah, it's not good.
Essentially, you know.
That's not going
31
to.
If you want to get more technical, but.
It's not going to do anything for you. I mean, is this
game a little bit of a run?
But this. Does this change anything in your thoughts? I mean, it's nice to see them win, I guess. But, I mean, does it – oh, now you saw some things now that maybe they can get it going? I don't know. I mean, it's just – Missouri's not a good team. They weren't a good team at all. They came in – they're very similar to Arkansas where they have a good player or two but can't get anything consistently going.
Even their records are almost identical. 2-4 for the Razorbacks down league play, 1-4. For Missouri in the league, 10-7 for the season for Missouri. Arkansas is 11-7. So, I mean, what they've done this year as far as wins and losses is close to identical.
Yeah. And I mean,
Is that even right? You can't be close to identical. You're either identical or you're not. They're very similar.
We'll make it work. Yeah. Close to identical works for me. But, of course, Arkansas, you know, Isaiah Joe's nice to see him get back in his winning ways and able to hit his shot. 7 of 12 from the three-point line for Isaiah Joe. He finishes with 23 points. Yeah. Led all scores. Daniel Gafford has 13 points, 10 rebounds. He took you 6 of 9 shooting, 1 of 5 from the free throw line. So still brutal there. But then Jalen Harris adds in 10 points of his own. I don't know what's going on with Mason Jones, but he looked like a guy that was really bringing it for a few games there. 2 of 10 shooting for him, 2 of 8 from the three-point line. Just, you got to get him going if you want to have any chances. But he's just not been able to find the basket here as of late.
About the time he's curtailed his point production, Isaiah Joe's brought his up. Isaiah Joe started out in league play first three games, not very good. And now Isaiah Joe's had a couple of good games, double-digit performances. But if you could get those two and Gafford going at the same time, that's the key for a run. Active defense, pressure defense without fouling, and three guys in double digits, you're going to have probably two of them close to 20. I think the three of them got to combine for 55 or 60 to give your team a real chance to win because you lack the depth. So those three players to beat the quality teams in the SEC are all going to have to be on at the same time. And other teams have been able to take that away so far.
Well, and I will say this, too. When we had Alex Schiffer on our show yesterday, I asked him about what will it take for Arkansas to take care of business against Missouri. What are they going to have to exploit? And the thing that he brought up was causing turnovers. He says as far as Arkansas' style of play, it's really the worst type of style that Missouri could go up against because they have not been very good of handling the ball. And I don't think it could have been more right. 24 turnovers for Missouri. Now, I'm giving Arkansas a lot of credit. They caused a lot of those turnovers. But, I mean, you're not going to win games turning it over 24 times. Nope. Missouri was not a team that handled the ball very well. They did not handle the pressure very well that Arkansas put on. And Arkansas really got the defense going late as of well, too. So there were a lot of factors that went into this game and a lot of reasons why Arkansas won. And, again, it was nice to see them get back on the winning ways as it seemed like it was really down and out. But I just don't know what it's like. At what point is it going to really get to change where you start thinking, okay, maybe this team's got to turn around? Because going on the road this week and when they have Texas Tech,
yeah,
I mean, yeah, that'd be huge if they won and maybe people start believing, but you also have to be realistic. I don't see that happening.
You don't get much of a chance for a streak to be put together. That's the problem is Arkansas, you'd hope to go on a 3-4-5-game winning streak and kind of level some things out with your record, gain some real confidence, but, you know, the schedule works out till you go to Texas Tech. Now, it's a real opportunity to go to Texas Tech, too, go out to Lubbock, and if you win that game, I don't think any of us believe they will, then you're talking about Arkansas in a different level of performance. That'd be the best win of the year, no question. Be better than Indiana. I mean, what is the best win of the year right now?
Indiana? Has to be.
I mean, I don't know what else would rival that. You got two SEC. It's not A&M. Not Missouri, Indiana's, but this would be your best win of the year. And I would go to say be not the best win for, maybe for Mike Anderson, but one of the better wins in his 8 years. To go on the road and beat a top 10, I don't know what the rank this week, but they've been around 8.
They're 14th.
They did lose to Iowa State about a week ago, so they've dropped out of the top 10, but still a solid top 15 team, a team that's going to be probably a 3 or a 4 seed, you would suspect, for the NCAA tournament. Be a quality win. And when your net rankings right now, I think going into the game last night was 86 or something, around 80 for Arkansas. You need a boost like that.
They lost also to Kansas State on Tuesday. Okay. So they lost by like 10 on the road.
So they're reeling a little bit. Yeah. That's what you're saying. Arkansas can have a chance.
It's not what I'm saying. I'm just telling you who they lost
to. Yeah. But see, that's the thing is that if... Say if Arkansas did do this and find a way to pull off a victory against them, then, yeah, I think that would get a lot of people to start believing and start thinking that they would be really in back into it, I guess you should say.
Mm-hmm.
But
you'd start to believe again.
Yeah, because like you said, it's hard to get a streak going because if you just look at Arkansas' schedule for the next few games, okay, so say if they just pull out, wow, they beat Texas Tech on the road. Okay. Well, then they have Georgia at home, which Georgia's not a good team, but then they go on the road to LSU, who's looking really good right now, and they are a top 25 team. So you could probably lose that one. But then you have Vanderbilt back at home, who's terrible. They almost beat Tennessee last night, by the way. Went to overtime, but they're not a good team. It's like, okay, so maybe you can get it going. But then you go on the road to South Carolina, which has been playing really good.
Yeah.
And then, oh, maybe you can beat Missouri on the road, but then you have Mississippi State at home, and then add Auburn after that. So, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's just hard to get a streak going, and that's really what's been the best thing about Mike Anderson's teams is that – anytime that they were in conference play and they were looking to have a turnaround or really have a nice stretch down the stretch to be able to make the NCAA tournament is always when they went on a winning streak. And if they go on any sort of winning streak this year, that means that they're probably going to have to beat a top 25 team or two to be able to have one.
The path to making it, you got 13 regular season games left, counting Texas Tech. You got 12 conference games this weekend. So we're of the belief that you got to probably get 10 SEC victories. So they're going to have to win to make the tournament. Probably, barring winning in Nashville, winning it all, they're going to have to win 10 of the last 12.
Not happening.
No, but pardon me. They're going to have to win 8 of the last 12.
Still not happening. I mean, the SEC's just
too early.
Good.
I hadn't had my coffee. Did my math right. 8 of the last 12 in league play.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen crazy things happen, but...
And that gets you to 19 wins. If you beat Texas Tech, that would be 20. But that's where they're at. 8 of the last 12 SEC games gets you to 10 league wins. We think 10 is probably the number to to get into the tournament.
Yeah, the minimum that you have to win in the SEC.
So they've won two. They got to win eight more to get to 10, obviously.
Yeah. So we'll
I know it's early, but 8-2 is still 10 with me.
Works for me. Promise there would be no math here on the Morning Rush.
Late night last night.
Yeah, that's right.
Follow the show on Twitter at HitThatLineAR. You're listening to the Bud Light Morning Rush podcast.
Now he does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number three, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs! Holy Hog!
I wanted to bring this up. I don't know if you guys got to see this report about what the NCAA Football Oversight Committee is looking at doing, or at least some possible changes when it comes to targeting and overtime. But I wanted to bring these up and get this into discussion because it feels like the most controversial penalty or call or whatever in college football is targeting, because it'll look like one thing's targeting but then ends up not being, but then it looks like one thing doesn't look like targeting, ends up being targeting. There's the reviews that go on. It's gotten better.
You don't think it's consistent. I mean,
right.
And that's one reason they've put in the command centers to try to have one person giving input on that, so you got the same set of eyes looking at a lot of these plays.
Right.
So you get some consistency.
Right. And I don't think it's a bad call and a bad rule to have targeting, because you don't need
it's a safety issue.
Yeah, which totally get. But I guess when it first started, though, was it's targeting, but then if they review it, you don't get ejected, but then the penalty is still enforced? I think it's how it originally was, and then they stopped that, where if they can overturn the penalty and the ejection. Now they're looking at, they're considering, and this is coming from the committee chairman, Shane Lyons. He says, we would consider changes of how it's done from the officiating aspect, from the ejection aspect of it, but they're doing more study, saying they don't want to back up off the penalty because they don't want to send the message if it's okay to do it, because it's a health and safety issue, but like it's talked about. But it seems like it's one of those rules, though, that when, especially when targeting, it has changed games, and not only in the game that a current player has been in, but for instance, when I guess was it Devin White for LSU, who was ejected late in the second half of a game, then he had to miss the first half of the Alabama game,
right?
Which again was controversial. So I am all for this, and Tommy, I know you're kind of a guy that is very familiar with officiating and all of that, because you want to get it right, but it feels like there should be almost close to kind of like what you have with flagrant fouls in football, where you have tiers, where there's flagrant one, flagrant two, have something similar in targeting, where one, it warrants a penalty but doesn't warrant ejection, and then the other one does both.
Well, I think you've got to look at indicators on this. Did you lead with the crown of the helmet? Were you trying to use the helmet as a weapon? You know, that's what is at the base of a lot of this. Were you trying to punish your opponent with a blow to the head? Those are the kind of hits, these hits we have idolized for decades in football, where a guy just gets, particularly a sitting duck like a quarterback in the pocket, gets taken out with a shot to the head. We used to glorify these. ESPN would put out highlight videos, VHSs back in the day of these. Those are the kind of hits that we now have enough data to understand this is dangerous. This is what leads to lifelong impairments and problems after football. Got to get these out of the game. It's a safety issue. How many times have we seen players going in? You know, it's not often you see these kind of things, but there's been just as many instances, it seems like, where a player's trying to deliver that kind of blow, they get their head too low and they have a neck injury that is life altering. I mean, this game ultimately is a violent
game.
And that's one of the reasons we are so passionate about it. But we need to do, I mean, it just doesn't make sense to have knowledge of how to keep people safe and then not apply it. You got to have rules in place, or there's a lot of other things, legal and otherwise, but just morally, if you know, hey, this is bad for a guy that could end up in a wheelchair, let's do what we can to mitigate that.
Yeah, drinking his food out of a straw when he gets older.
And those aren't overstatements. Those are not exaggerations. Those are things that have happened. You know, you don't want someone paralyzed because they're trying to get on a highlight reel, trying to be in a SportsCenter top 10 play. And so I think you got to have indicators. Did they lead with the crown of the helmet? Did they lower their head, and were they trying to punish the opponent? And I think you could put in certain steps. Did this, and this occur on the play? Yes, then it merits ejection. If only one of the three occurred, maybe it didn't. So the problem is it all happens so fast. And then the players trying to do, maybe the defensive players trying to do the right thing, and then the offensive player lowers or crouches his body to avoid contact, and then it becomes helmet to helmet when the hit was never intended to be helmet to helmet. There are just so many moving parts and pieces where you're trying to nail it down to these criterias, and this is how it absolutely is. It's hard to do.
And, well, the thing is I think you can have two extremes to it, because there are, in some cases, some people feel like there has been rules, especially in the NFL, especially dealing with the quarterback, that have made it to where it's almost been not football because of the fact that you can't hit them certain places, certain ways, certain thing. Like, you know, saw the, I know it was a bad penalty call, but like what Tom Brady, when they had a roughing the passer or whatever on him.
Well,
I know
that was just a missed call.
That was a missed call.
But they're so, I think the point is on that play, Cleet Blakeman, who's the referee in that game, is looking, and a defensive player swings like he is trying to hit near the head. He misses. I don't know why or what he was swinging at. Only he could tell you. But it was clearly a swing and a miss, not a swing and landed contact. They have really put in a lot of rules because those quarterbacks are sitting back there sitting ducks. Mm-hmm. These other guys are moving at full speed. You hit them in the knee, you're going to tear out a knee. I mean, they've really talked about the strike zone, above the knee, below the shoulders. What's wrong with hitting someone at the waistline or in the chest? It's much safer there. Trying to keep you out of the extremes. Lower extremities, above the shoulders. Mm. That's where you don't need to go in and create the contact, particularly on a quarterback.
Yeah, which, I totally get. And I think it's also been a factor that, and I'm not saying that I've ever played professional football, and I don't think you could ever even make that argument that I ever even got close to that.
Glad you cleared that up.
I know. I had to clear the air. There's been some rumors.
I couldn't make the argument.
Yeah, there's been some rumors floating around. But it also feels like that those are the two places as far as above the shoulders and below the knees that also makes it easier for a defensive player to try to make the tackle because they don't have to get as low. I'm just saying, but just because that's what
it's easier to make a tackle below the knee?
No, I'm saying that it's easier for them to have with their form. It's easier for them to dive at somebody that low to try to knock them out because they know that if they can get to that point, they're not going to jump over them. They're not going to break that tackle. And some people, and it's been like that same way where it's just been more difficult for people to adhere to that.
I think it is more difficult to have to say you have to tackle a guy this way. So, and I don't know if that's where you were going, but I do think if you say, hey, you have a smaller frame to hit a guy, because in the past it was just get a guy down by any means.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a lot easier than, hey, you have half of his body and this is where you can't hit him. And then it kind of depends. Is it a quarterback? Is it a ball carrier? Mm-hmm. Where are they at? How are you coming?
Yeah.
What's your angle? Because there are a bunch of hits to where if the guy didn't fall out and act like he was dead, it wouldn't be called, in my opinion, as a target.
It's the violent, full speed, helmet to helmet contact that is of the most concern.
Right. Yeah, and you got to do what you can to avoid that. And I also feel like that, say for instance, what I'm saying is you have a defensive player like a cornerback or a safety or somebody like that, and he's having to go up against somebody like Rob Gronkowski. He's not going to be able to get that guy down just by hitting him in the waistline. I mean, maybe he could, just depending on who it is. Mm-hmm. So he's got to find other means. So that's why they've gone low, and which is dangerous.
But the rule on the going low is really on the quarterback,
right?
I mean, particularly the college game.
But it's the same thing.
Quarterback low. I mean, you can hit.
How are you going to get Ben Roethlisberger down?
Well,
you know that's what I'm saying. Like you got big quarterbacks, you got big guys. Yeah, how are you going to get them
in the NFL? They're paying these guys how many tens of millions?
I know. You get paid to do it.
Who makes the rules? The guys writing those checks.
Oh, I know it.
They're not going to let their quarterbacks, their most prized possessions, their biggest investments, they're going to make rules to protect those guys.
They certainly have.
Well, I mean, when Tom Brady was out for a knee, what's that been? Six or seven seasons ago?
When Matt Castle came in.
Correct.
Yeah.
It hurt ratings.
It did.
It hurt the whole league. So, I mean, is the league better off to keep a guy like Tom Brady on the field? Is it a better business decision? Is it a good business decision to keep your quarterbacks, your best quarterbacks on the field?
Well, yeah, no, it's a good decision.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Yes,
it's a good decision. Of course it is. I mean, that's all this is at the end of the day, particularly at the pro level. It's a good business decision. You protect. I mean, if you had a machine in your plant that produced the most amount of product in the shortest amount of time and made you the most money, you would probably give it the most amount of maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all these rules are. They're just maintenance for your best machinery.
Yeah.
In the college game, I think the fear at all levels, somebody's got to die on the field from a hit. Instant. I mean, they're running down the field. Someone ear holes them. Someone hits them in the head. Something happens, and they don't get up. And it's not like they're knocked out, bring out the smelling salt. They don't get up, and it's a fatal blow.
Because if that happens,
that is the fear of every commissioner. That is the fear of everyone that has a stake in the game. And if there's not rules in place that they're trying to do all they can to mitigate and limit the real dangers, can you imagine the lawsuits? Mm. Can you imagine the payouts? Particularly in the NFL, where it's a nearly $10 billion sport.
They'll be writing checks forever.
Oh, man. Kill the sport.
Yep. No, and I understand that.
And it shouldn't come to the point someone's going to die. I'm really concerned about the future of the game. And I think it comes back to this, because I think you got mamas that are now in their 20s and early 30s that are raising kids that are 5th, 6th, 7th grade. And now we're talking a minute ago about Xbox and Fortnite. Mm-hmm. And kids have things that they're more interested in, at like my kid. He's 9 today. Today's his birthday. And, you know, football's not his prime interest right now. Now, maybe that changes as he gets old, but he's far more into games and stuff. And I don't particularly like that. I don't understand that. But I'm hoping that when he gets closer to 6th and 7th grade, football or sports become a greater interest. I think there's a lot of parents that are not as encouraging of that, because they're worried about concussions. They're worried about injuries. They're worried about that, and they overlook all the benefits of being involved in a team sport. And it's things like we're talking about here with these rules trying to keep players safe, that moms and dads see things on TV about guys with concussions and they think it's going to happen in 7th grade football. And now kids aren't coming out. Numbers are lower. Fewer young athletes are getting involved in football at the earliest ages when they need to learn the game. Well, what's the future of the sport? I think it's in danger.
Mm-hmm. And they have a right to have that fear going on.
No parent doesn't want to do them. They think they're protecting their kid.
Yeah.
And maybe they are. You know, the thing you've got to balance is the benefit of being involved in a team sport, the benefit of being around a team, having a coach, having just all that goes along. You played high school football. There's lifelong lessons you learn from that.
For sure.
That you take with you for the rest of your life, today and for the rest of your life. You miss out on a lot of that when you don't get involved. And the fear right now that's driving all this is head injuries.
Mm-hmm. Of course, when I was playing football, I was just more afraid of not getting in trouble and having to do conditioning, because I hated conditioning. I hated running, but you know, I see what you're saying, and I agree with you. It's just a matter of people trying to protect their
kids. You got a lot of young parents out there that
they're not for it.
They're against football because of things like this. Yeah. And I just think there's an assault on the sport right now.
Yeah, but they got to find a way to fix it, and they got to find a way to make it as safe as possible. That is for sure.
Subscribe to the show on iTunes. You're listening to the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast.
Give is to Alex Collins straight up the middle, and Collins on the run. They won't catch him. Alex Collins is going to take it all the way to the house. Touchdown, Arkansas, 80 yards.
Let's go to the phone lines. We are now joined by Richard Davenport of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Going to get into a little recruiting. Richard, I hear that you're in Vegas. How's the view from out there?
I just had to try to pull one on tight. No, it's great. I've been up all night, so if I slur a little bit, guys, I apologize.
The tables must have been good to you then, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I can hear you
not have me on next week.
Yeah, I can hear the euphoria in your voice. Yeah.
Well, you never step away from a here there, Richard. So, but we appreciate you making some time for us this morning. So let's jump right into it. I guess one of the biggest news, of course, was the fact that John Scott, the interior defensive line coach, has moved from Arkansas, taking a position at South Carolina, and it seems that it's already had some impact on the recruiting trail. What'd you make about this move from John Scott, and what type of impact has it truly have on the recruiting class, not only this year, but for the years to come?
Well, I mean, I think John showed, you know, with Armand Watts, you know, a guy that just made a tremendous jump from junior to senior year and probably would get drafted in the NFL. I think he did a pretty good job with what he had last year, and his ability to recruit was pretty good too. There are several kids the last year of Brett from Georgia that he was on, and they possibly could have gotten if they were if they wanted him. And but he did get Dante Walker, who decommitted. I think that's more of a case where Arkansas is kind of loaded up on DNs, and they're really trying to focus on linebackers. So. But anyway, John really wanted to get closer to his kids. His kids are in South Carolina. He hadn't been able to really spend a lot of time with them over the last few years, and it was really a family move for him.
We haven't talked to you since last weekend. Obviously, some winter weather, mild winter weather moved through here, but enough to put some precipitation on the ground and on some of the streets. It was a big weekend. I know Chad Morris and his staff welcomed a lot of folks in. There was even some tweets and some stories out about him having to de-ice the roads in his own neighborhood to get those guests to his home. How did last weekend go as you followed up with some of those recruits?
It went well. You know, most of those guys are already committed to him, and then you had some preferred walk-on guys. And, you know, John David White was one of them who committed to him this week. I think he's a huge addition. You know, if you're talking about preferred walk-ons, I saw him against BB earlier this year, and saw him take a 5-yard pass and turn it into 95 yards. And man, the guy got some serious speed. A lot of people compare him to Drew Morgan. He's a faster Drew Morgan. Now, will he have the same type of career as Drew? That remains to be seen. I don't know, but the parents went over to Coach Morris's house at that evening for a social meeting or whatever you want to say, and he just wanted to make sure that they could get there, and obviously that was a priority for him.
Speaking with Richard Davenport of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette right now on the Morning Rush. Richard, what are the assistant coaches going to be doing? I know that Joe Craddock and Justice Stepp, they've been taking some visits. They've been visiting some of these big-time recruits, especially in some of the bigger recruiting hotbeds like Houston. Just what's the overall update on what these coaches are doing, who they're looking at, and how's it all going right now?
Going well. Obviously, they're probably more focused on the 2020 and 2021 classes right now, because pretty much the 2019 class is pretty much in the haze in the barn, so to speak. Just trying to nail down a few other guys, but other than that, they're really focusing on the future, and I think that's going to bode well. Come February and March and during spring practice when they have kids on campus, just going by and seeing these kids, you know, hey, they keep that in account. That really means a lot to them, knowing that the coach has made a special trip just to check on them. So that's really what they're focused on right now, and some of it just going by schools and shaking hands and just developing relationships too.
I want to switch it up a little bit, Richard, and get into the basketball side of things. Something that we discussed earlier in the show was about with this basketball team. Obviously, they've had their struggles, they've had their frustrations, but it's about looking at the future. And we all can assume that Daniel Gafford will be leaving after this season, trying his hand at the NBA. And it looks like what Arkansas is left with as far as big men go, there's not a lot of options there. So a lot of people have been wondering, what is the future plan for replacing Daniel Gafford? Because nothing against Reggie Chaney or Gabe Osaboyan or any of those guys, but you need to have an inside presence. Is Arkansas and Mike Anderson, are they looking at anybody? Then maybe a JUCO route, grad transfer route? Like, what's the overall situation going on with trying to find a big man to help Arkansas out in the coming years?
They've offered a JUCO big guy, and they've offered Raymond Hawkins, who's at, he's a 6'9", 230-pound post player, mostly just mainly in the paint, type guy, good physical, athletic kid who is at Finley Prep in Las Vegas. They offered him not too long ago. He plans to make an official visit soon after his season ends at the end of February. He's got a lot of Arkansas ties. His late grandfather and his late great great grandmother are from Arkansas. And another connection he has is Darnell Robinson. He's from Oakland. Darnell Robinson is a family friend with his mom and his uncle. So, obviously, I'm sure he's picking the brains of of them about Arkansas, but he seems very interested. And last time I talked to him, Arkansas was the only school that he lined up for an official. He's taken some other official visits, but he just hasn't lined them up just yet. But he's a guy to keep an eye on. And I think right now, if you had to say that there's one guy that I really feel good about them possibly getting for a post position, it's Raymond Hawkins.
Another question that a lot of people have is, it seems like, especially under Mike Anderson, that you've always been able to rely on an in-state kid, a big-time in-state kid, to step in and really help out. You saw that with Bobby Portis. You saw it with Daniel Gafford. Even a guy like Daryl Macon, which I know he went the JUCO route, but he still wanted to be a Razorback. They've always been able to benefit from having players like that. Just looking also at the coming years, as far as the in-state talent goes, are there realistic options for Arkansas to get any big-time players? Are there any big-time players that are going to be coming out of the state here in the coming years?
Well, obviously, when Moses Moody moved to Florida for prep school, that's one guy that you're still recruiting, but he's not in-state, and you'd love for him to just be in-state and hear about the Razorbacks all the time, but obviously that's not going to happen. But you have Jalen Williams, a 2020 post player from Fort Smith Northside, who's got a lot of upside. He's not quite there yet, but he's got a nice outside shot. He can hit the three. But the 2020 class and the 2021 classes have some guys that could potentially turn into some really fine in-state prospects, higher Division I type guys.
It's going to be interesting to see how it goes. Richard Davenport of the Arkansas Democrat is at. Great stuff, Richard. Enjoy yourself and behave yourself there in Vegas, my man. We'll be catching up with you next week, all right?
All right, guys. Take care.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Like the Bud Light Morning Rush podcast? Check out the Halftime Pod and Ruskin is Ranting podcast on HitThatLine.com.